She loves me. She loves me not. He loves me. He loves me not. That's a game played by someone plucking petals off of a flower. And the petals supposedly represents the truth about the object of their affection. Do they love me or do they love me not? Now, on Valentine's Day, it's not unusual to want to know you are loved and that you do love. However, as family and couples therapist Arie Sidicue says, love is not always embraced by everyone. In fact, there are people who are love avoidant. In other words, they choose to remain single. So the factors that lead to this are complex, but they appear to be linked to the relationship that the person had with their primary caregiver early in life. Sidicue says there may have been a negative relationship. There may have been a smothering relationship. There may have been an emotionally void relationship. All of these are factors that could lead a child to be reluctant, suspicious, or afraid of intimacy. We invited Arie Sidicue to join us for a conversation that matters about love, our need to connect, and how to hopefully get past love avoidance.
Conversations That Matter is a partner program of the Center for Dialogue at Simon Fraser University. The production of this program is made possible thanks to the following and viewers like you. Please become a patron at conversationsthatmatter.tv.
Welcome to Conversations That Matter on this Valentine's Day special, but we're taking a look at love from a different perspective, love avoidance. Mm-hmm. What exactly is love avoidance, and why is it something that we need to be paying attention to?
Well, I'd like us to start actually with the history of these terms,
okay.
Avoidance and attachment. So the idea of love avoidance comes from attachment theory, which is a theory of how people form their primary social relationships. That can be in infancy with a caregiver, in adulthood that's with your partner or partners. It's how do you really have a close, loving relationship with somebody. So love avoidance or an avoidant attachment style comes from a series of experiments that a couple of researchers did in the late 1950s.
Mm-hmm.
What they noticed was children separated from their parents at the end of World War II. A bunch of children were sent off to protect them to the countryside.
Right.
They became interested in the social development of those children. Later in 1950s, Mary Ainsworth took on this research project and developed a way of assessing the attachment bond that children have with their parents.
Mm-hmm.
So what she found was that there were three categories of ways that people connected with their caregiver. And these caregiving relationships, they give us a template for how we connect with other people whom we have close relationships with across our lifetime. So she found that there's a group of infants that have secure attachment. That means they display distress at the parting with the mother, and they very quickly reconnect with the mother when she returns.
Mm-hmm.
And are easily soothed and are able to take that connection in. There's a group of infants that she found were avoidant. So they were avoidant of the relationship with the caregiver, which meant that researchers observed that the children weren't as distressed at the parting with the caregiver. And when the caregiver returned, they were slow to reconnect. They either ignored the entrance of the caregiver into the experimental space, or it took them some time to reconnect, make some eye contact, re-engage in a shared play activity. So that's where this idea of being love avoidant comes from, which is having an attachment style that avoids connection.
Okay, it's interesting to hear you say that, because as you're talking about the attachment, of course,
mm-hmm.
I think of the work of Adolf Adler,
mm-hmm.
and how this is a primary concern to the child.
Mm-hmm.
Like, how am I attached to my parent?
That's right.
Does my parent love me? And this gives me a sense of comfort, self,
yes.
Self-worth.
That's right.
How is it that, it seems antithetical to me that some children would go, well, no, even from early stage in life,
mm-hmm.
I'm avoidant of that.
Mm-hmm.
Do we understand the reasons why that may exist?
There are some theories. So we don't know how much of this attachment pattern is passed down through DNA. We know through epigenetics that certain genes can be expressed in a parent, mm-hmm. and that gene expression is passed down to the offspring. So we don't know how much of an attachment pattern is passed down through genetics.
And or epigenetics. Or, isn't that an interesting
or idea? Epigenetics, yeah. Yes. And we don't know how much of it is related to early childhood experiences of caregiving.
Mm-hmm.
But the theory is that infants who develop an avoidant approach to attachment either have had their cues for distress and comfort ignored or not tended to, or they've been prematurely encouraged to go out there and be independent. Alternatively, they might have experienced caregiving as intrusive, as intruding upon their self or their personal space, and so developed avoidance as a protective strategy. So,
okay, I got to jump in and ask you,
sure.
So is that the child already realizes that the parent is being overly engaged or overly protective and not giving them the opportunity to explore the world for themselves?
That's what I mean by intrusive, exactly, yes.
And are we, okay, I don't know whether or not we can say for sure, yes, this is what's happening, but
mm-hmm.
are we seeing an increase in that kind of behavior in a culture such as ours here in North America, where more and more parents are so worried about, what are the life prospects of my child? I'm going to get in there and I'm going to, try and navigate their way through life for them.
You're talking about helicopter parenting.
Yes, okay.
Yes. Yeah. And which is not an official research term, so that's a colloquial term.
That, yes. Okay, let's go back 100 years ago, and maybe a little bit more, where the encouragement to parents was, have as many children as you can,
mm-hmm.
because not all of them are going to survive.
Mm-hmm.
You need help on the farm.
Mm-hmm.
All of these things. And the parent went, good, you can walk and talk now, look after yourself. I'm
look
there.
Look after your siblings. Yeah.
And don't be such a bad little whatever.
Yes.
And, but the relationship was, yeah, I'm here, we're there for the big stuff, we're protecting you, but we're not actually in your lives the way that we see today.
Yes.
And I remember hearing somebody talking about, and I can't give attribution to who it was because I can't remember who it was, but they were saying, well, now we've gone to a 1 and 2 children families,
mm-hmm.
where this baby is so precious to the couple now,
mm-hmm.
that the parent is overly engaged.
Mm-hmm. There's also been another shift. So we've gone from communal living to nuclear families. We've gone from large family homes, multiple family homes, to individual family homes. So where a child might have had attachment and caregiving relationships with multiple adults, mm-hmm. might have had that need met through multiple sources, we now have two parents who are usually both working in this day and age, and have various other stressors to attend to.
So with a child who has been love avoidant,
mm-hmm.
How does that impact their need for connectedness, which is a universal need? We need to
That's
connect
right.
with somebody else.
In research with these infants, what researchers found was that the physiological level of distress was about the same in avoidant children and in securely attached children when the caregiver left and when the caregiver returned or when the caregiver was absent.
But for different reasons.
Well, we don't know the reasons because
they're
infants.
Okay, true. Okay, yeah.
But the level of distress was there. So theoretically speaking, these infants feel the need to connect. They feel that the need is there, but they don't know how to operationalize it. They don't
mm-hmm.
know how to act on it. And something similar happens in adult love relationships.
Yes.
Where a person might feel the need for close connection, for attention, for affection, but may not trust that the relationship is able to provide that. They may believe that their relationship is superficial or is not going to last. They might anticipate the failure of the relationship. So, or they might anticipate engulfment. They might anticipate that this partnership is going to fundamentally alter their sense of self in a way that feels overwhelming. So these are some of the fears that can manifest.
This avoidant behavior, is it just I'm going to stay away from relationships, or they enter into relationships the way that most of us do, which is some kind of infatuation with a bonding that comes together.
Yes.
And then they go, whoa, or are they just like avoiding the relationship altogether?
It really depends on the person there and their scale of attachment avoidance, or their scale of avoidance in attachments. So some people might find that their story around relationships is so discouraging that they don't enter into relationships at all. They don't believe that there's any possibility of having a fulfilling relationship, so they don't try. Some people might find these avoidant patterns emerging in couple relationships as their partner wants closer, wants more intimacy, wants closeness, and there's some conflict in how they meet that need. So it depends on where you fall in the spectrum of avoidance.
So if you don't enter into a relationship, well, it's really hard to say, well, here's how you can address that in your relationship.
Right.
But if you're in a relationship and you go through that honeymoon period, which I think whether it's an avoidant relationship or not, there's still going to be that attachment. Wow, aren't you the most amazing person?
Yes.
I want to spend all my time with you, and I want to collapse that space that exists between us and meld as one. But then there's this point where you start to go, okay, now I don't know that I can trust this.
Yeah.
How in a relationship then do you address that if the avoidant person says, okay, I got to get beyond this? Because I'm sure that there's a lot of people going, okay. I've been to that place.
Yes.
How do I move beyond my own fear, and how does my partner work with me to develop a more lasting relationship?
So first, if a person has reached a point where they're aware of their pattern and they want to change it, I really want to applaud them, because that's one of the biggest tasks, is to realize that there's an unconscious or a subconscious pattern operating that you're not really in control of. So that's one of the, awareness is one of the biggest pieces, to know this is your relational script that's operating, this is what it says about the relationship, and actually, hey, it doesn't match the reality of the relationship that I'm in. After awareness, you come to really having a vision of what you would like to do in a relationship. So if you find yourself believing that this relationship is going to overwhelm you, this relationship is going to fail, if you find yourself having negative anticipatory reactions to the relationship, you really want to shift your focus and build that image of what a securely attached relationship looks like for you. So what would be an ideal way to connect? What are the benefits of having that kind of closeness in your relationship with your person? And where might that get you in life, to have a close connection with someone whom you can bring your fears, your worries, and your joys and your explorations to? So really hanging on to the benefits of that change.
When you're in a relationship, it's not just romance.
That's right.
A relationship is also about self-actualization. And so despite the fact that there's connectedness, there also has to be, as Carl Jung pointed out, individuation.
That's
like, I have to be me and you have to be you.
That's right.
So how, when there's power struggles and all these things that are going on, do you get to that point where you say, all right, we're going to get beyond that honeymoon period, and we're going to slog our way through the messy work of trying to figure out what the dynamics of this relationship are so that we can both realize our full potential as human beings. Are there tips and tricks? I know that we only have like a certain amount of time to deal with this, but there has to be an essential core of what represents a healthy relationship that allows both partners to grow and develop.
I'm going to do something very frustrating, which is a very therapy thing to do, and it's to say there isn't one fixed answer for for that question.
I don't find that frustrating.
Okay.
We're talking about human beings.
Exactly.
Yeah.
We're talking about human beings. Human beings change and evolve, as do relationships. So there are times in relationships where there's a greater amount of connectedness. There are times in relationships where there's a greater amount of separateness.
Yeah.
And we've been able to track, for example, in the prime part of a relationship cycle where there's caregiving responsibilities to aging parents, there's caregiving responsibilities to children, there's work responsibilities, there's your own social responsibilities. At those times, a separateness might be the dominant cycle that you're in.
Right.
Earlier in the relationship, togetherness might have been the dominant cycle that you were in. So,
well, you kind of have to have that, don't you? How on earth are you going to get beyond the natural aversion to somebody else's idiosyncrasies if you don't have that closeness?
That's right.
Yeah.
So how do you make sure that you're balancing individuation and connection? I think people have each person has their own internal set point for that.
Mm-hmm.
I would say people who have an avoidant attachment pattern maybe have a greater need for individuation than connection,
mm-hmm.
or at least they believe that they do. People who are on the other side, people who are ambivalently attached, I would say have a greater need for connection than individuation. So it depends where you are developmentally with that.
Mm-hmm.
And where you are in your life with that. I think everyone has an internal knowing about what they need to do to really feel like themselves.
So even within the relationship therapeutic world, there mm-hmm. are different schools of thoughts or different practices.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm familiar with the Imago model, which says, well, you work all this stuff out in a relationship.
Mm-hmm.
You find someone else who has had a similar kind of wound,
mm-hmm.
And together you work your way through that, which yes. can be incredibly challenging.
Yes.
Because you're both dealing with the same trauma.
That's right.
But that's not the only model. And how important, and what are some of the other models that might be available to somebody, and how important is it that you find that right one for you?
You find the right one for individuating
yeah.
correctly.
Yeah.
Because
ultimately that's what it is. I have to be the best me with myself
yes.
to be the best me in the relationship.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
The research around individuation has evolved. So I'm thinking of research on shame and compassion that, who is that very famous, currently very famous researcher who does that research on shame and interconnectedness? You don't know who I'm talking about.
I don't know who you're talking
okay.
about. Okay. Nope, can't pull it up.
Brené Brown. There
okay.
we go.
All right.
So she's been doing some research on how it is that people have a sense of belonging. And the flip side to that is that the people who have the greatest sense of belonging are the same people who are the most willing to stand up for what matters to them. It's a paradox, isn't it? It's a
yes.
little bit of a, it's a double think. So the more you are willing to be true to yourself, the more you're able to connect with others in an authentic way, the more you're able to feel that the person that people are connecting with is actually you. That's one model. In some earlier family therapy models, there's the concept of differentiation, which means that you're able to be in a relationship without being reactive to the other person's need for connection and closeness. That's another concept. What is the most useful concept? Or I want to say that the common factors research in therapy actually says that only 15% of the outcomes of therapy are related to the particular model that a therapist is using. So I wouldn't say that the model is as important as the quality of your effort to really build closeness in an authentic way.
So it's between the two partners?
That's right.
and also the person that they're seeking assistance from.
If they choose to, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so it's the dynamics of that relationship.
That's right.
Which is the dynamics of building a healthy relationship.
That's right. So that's one of the tasks of a therapist is to assess the quality of the interpersonal relationship between the therapist and the client, and there get some information about, oh, how does this client connect with other beings in the world?
Well, I think partly based on when we're releasing this, and which is going to actually be on Valentine's Day, which mm-hmm. is a day of celebration of love.
Mm-hmm.
It is a wonderful connection, and probably the most important thing that we can do for ourselves and our lives is find that healthy relationship with mm-hmm. somebody who helps us to be fulfilled, mm-hmm. and we, in turn, return the favor.
I'd like to expand that a little bit,
yes.
if it's okay. So we also know that attachment patterns don't only operate within close relationships, they operate also in friendships and work relationships, and in neighborships and communityships.
Yes.
I'd encourage people who are listening, we know that loneliness is an epidemic now in developed countries.
Right.
We know that people who experience chronic loneliness have poorer health outcomes, poorer physical health outcomes. So if you're one of those people, if you're feeling lonely or left out on Valentine's Day, I'd really encourage you to assess your expectations of how a friendship or a neighborship might work out. See if you can switch that to something more positive, more inviting of good possibilities, and reach out to the people in your life, even on Valentine's Day.
Valentine's Day can be a marker for every other day of the year, can't
yes,
it?
Yeah.
Yes. Well, thank you for coming in and sharing that with
us. Thank you very much, Stuart. Yeah.